Hello, friends, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. My guest today is James Mendez Hotz, a game designer, writer, and cultural consultant who you might know from his game Thousand Arrows, or his work on Scion and Seventh Sea, and the second edition of Monster Hearts, to name a few. Mendez also did some consulting work for the One Shot Network recently. You will soon get to listen to me run a session of one of my favorite games, Kagamatsu, on the One Shot podcast. That's going to be coming out in January, and I hope everyone will enjoy it. We recorded it earlier this year, and it was really great to have Mendez take a listen and give us a little bit of feedback on some things that I think we did okay and some things we could have done better. We'll talk about that a lot in the show, but we're also going to talk about history and play and martial arts. So let's jump right in.
The mighty god Zeus's will was accomplished when fighting those two was split up in contest. Atreides Lord of Men and Achilles with the Brilliance. Which of the gods willed these two to militants? Is that good?
Yeah, that is good. Cool. That's pretty fresh. Why don't we talk about the work that's involved in translating Homer's Iliad into a contemporary version?
Yes. Okay. So this is a project that I began as... This is a project I conceptualized as far back as high school, as my first year of Greek. And I remember my Greek teacher in 11th grade telling us all about the way that Greek poets performed the Iliad and the Odyssey. So each of those works is synthesized from a much, much larger tradition and boiled down to the version that we have today, kind of the same way that Rapper's Delight synthesized and plagiarized a lot of other rappers' work and condensed it all down into a single very long track. So Greek performers... So there was this epic poetic tradition of poetry that was partly freestyled and then partly memorized. A poet would make up the lines of poetry on his feet or her feet or their feet. We don't really know. But... They would extemporaneously come up with a great deal of their poetry based on who was in the audience, the ancestors of the people in the audience's tastes, and what they were feeling that day. And then in between those improvised sections, there would be formulae, which are kind of like choruses or hooks. They're memorized sections which the poet could go back to while they were making up the next segment of poetry. So it's a combination of freestyled and memorized verse. Subject matter-wise, there's a lot of focus on machismo and revenge and violence and booty and ostentatious modes of transportation. And the Greek itself is really, really different from any other kind of Greek that you would find anywhere in the classical canon. It has a lot of similarities with Attic Greek, Ionic Greek. There's bits of it borrowed from dialects and languages all across the Hellenic world. And the actual grammar and spelling and the actual syntax involved in Homeric Greek often departs from the norm and often departs from what's considered correct that you might learn in your first couple of years of Greek, because all that really matters is that it sounds all right to the beat. So a poet who memorized and performed the Iliad and the Odyssey once they were set down was called the Rhapsodos. And we have the same word for this today, essentially.
Wow.
So I often describe what I'm doing as translating Homer's Iliad into hip-hop, but that's not quite precise. It's a little bit more accurate to say I'm taking Homer's Iliad and presenting it in a format that is as close to the original format as I can come up with.
Mm-hmm. A strictly faithful translation.
Or, yes.
Or a dynamic translation, I guess.
Yes.
Right? One that's meant to have the same impact.
Right. Because, so I could do a literal translation, although there are many literal translations out there. which gets the exact meaning of the words, or I could do a translation that fits the beat of the original, which is dactylic hexameter. But those options, while they may be more precise, they aren't really as accurate or truthful as the experience of listening to the Iliad when it's rapped.
So when did you decide, like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to make this real?
So I decided that I was going to make it real my first year of college. So college was really hard for me, and I had a difficult time focusing and getting work done. And I went into college thinking I was going to be a classicist, and then found out over my time in Greek classes and Latin classes that it probably wasn't the right option for me, or it certainly wasn't the right option then, because Latin came easily to me, especially when I was a kid, but Greek really did not. And I flunked out of Homeric Greek, I think, 3 times in my life.
Wow.
And I just kept bashing my head against it, and then I couldn't do it until I came up with this concept. And it was one of those sort of hand of God moments. I feel sometimes like there's a thing that everyone is put on Earth to do, some mysterious skill which they are destined to be the best at.
Yeah.
And most people probably go through their entire lives without figuring out what that is or how they can do it, while at the same time trying to earn a living or not die of dysentery or not be conquered by invading armies or whatever. And I am lucky enough to have run into something that might be it for me. So even though Homeric Greek is something that I have failed at over and over in my life, I kept coming back to it because there's this kind of hand of God feeling about this translation. If I don't do this, no one's gonna do this. Mm-hmm. Or, well, I don't know. If a truck hits me tomorrow, probably someone else will pick up from my translation where I left off, which is nice. But I still feel like the universe is telling me, if you are weird enough to have had this idea, then you better see it through.
Where has the satisfaction in this work come from?
The moments that are most satisfying are when I run into a word or phrase or situation in the text which translators have struggled with over the centuries, which no one's ever quite been able to figure out, and then my format fixes that problem. For example, in book one of the Iliad, early on, the priest Chryses comes to the Achaean camp to try to plead with Agamemnon to get his enslaved daughter back. And he gives this entreaty, and then in the line afterwards it says the Greeks ep euphemeson. So that's this compound word. There's ep, which means upon, eu, which means well, and then phemeson, which means spoke. So it's the same root as euphemism, euphemeson, with an ep appended to the beginning. So they upon well good said. They hollowed back, that's what it means. there's another point at which Achilles is in this long rap battle with Agamemnon, and they're going back and forth, threatening each other and making all these proclamations, and Achilles has finally lost everything, and Agamemnon has seized all of these prizes from him and seized his favorite slave girl. And Achilles, when dissing him, calls him Demoboros Basileus, a king who devours his own people. And in rap, if you steal someone's work, if you steal someone's rhymes, you're biting on them.
Oh.
So not only the meaning, but also the idiom translates, and Achilles is able to say, you bite on your own crew. If this muster had a spine, they'd not fight to follow you. You'd have spit your final rhyme. So it's those moments. There's another part later on where Agamemnon is responding to Nestor, and he's complaining about Achilles. And he says, okay, old man, you're right about this, but this guy, Achilles, he wants to rule everyone, and to rule everyone, and to rule everyone, and also to rule over everyone. And he just uses 4 synonyms for rule over everyone. So in my version, he just says it once, and the DJ scratches it for a couple of lines. And so in book two, there's this catalog of ships, and it's really boring. It's just listing who all is showing up at the battle. And as in any, if I were an ancient Greek poet and I were looking out at my audience, I would make sure to include all of the members of my audience in my narration. I'd make sure that they were the ones throwing spears into people in the battle scenes, and they were the ones showing up in all of these great masses of combatants showing up at Troy. Mm-hmm. So that's really convenient for me because I can just do that as a shout out track and it'll go really quickly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I can put all my Patreon backers in it too because, oh. Right? Because that's realistic. And also, I want their money, so.
They're good, good money.
Yes.
That's wonderful. So this is something that you're writing. Do you see this being performed?
I would like to see it performed. One person has approached me about possibly turning this into a stage thing in the past.
Uh-huh.
And I can't really say more about that, but...
Oh, boy.
We'll see.
Okay, well, but it's, you know, just knock on wood or whatever.
Maybe I can say, yes, this is a stage performance of this is something that I have considered in the past, and it is something that others have considered also.
That's so exciting.
Thank you.
So, besides this thing, your life's work, yes. this passion that you have, I'm yes. also very interested in something that people have shown a lot of passion for. I heard from someone that your Thousand Arrows Long Con, I think it might have been a couple Metatopias ago, was like a peak gaming experience.
Yeah.
I'm doing this new thing where I'm trying to remind myself to explain terms when I use them.
Yes.
So, Metatopia, a game convention in New Jersey, and a Long Con. First of all, tell my listeners about what a long con is.
Sure. The long con format, originally called Christacon after Krista White, originated at a birthday party convention for the game designer, librarian, and otherwise excellent person, Krista White. Krista enjoys campaign games, or not necessarily long games. Krista enjoys games with arcs that are of multiple sessions, but at conventions rarely gets to get that campaign experience, although she doesn't always have time for that at home. So as a present for Krista, John Stavropoulos and Brennan Taylor, her husband, and several other people came up with this format where you would play out a whole arc of a game over multiple sessions at a convention. Mm. So that's a Christacon. Christacons can be both long and wide. If they're long, that means that they take place over multiple sessions. If they're wide, that means that there are multiple tables at the game,
right.
Which are all involved in doing parallel parts of the same story. So the Thousand Arrows. I should probably explain Thousand Arrows, shouldn't I?
Yeah, if you want to.
Sure. Okay. So Thousand Arrows is a game that Brennan Taylor and I are working on, which is a hack of Apocalypse World, which is about the Japanese Warring States period.
Yes.
So the Warring States period lasted from about 1467 to 1603 in Japan, and it was a period when ruthless samurai warlords split Japan up into a bunch of little factions, which were all struggling with each other for gold and resources and territory and guns. And it led to the unification of Japan under a cascading series of powerful rulers who all got betrayed or assassinated or died in this sort of amusing domino situation. So this is a time period of constant, it's a civil war that lasted 150 years or 140 years, something like that. So multiple generations were born and died during the course of this war that just did not end and just kept getting bigger and bigger. And, covered all of Japan, burst out of Japan, and attacked Korea on the way to trying to conquer China and therefore the world, and devastated Korea during the 1590s. And then at the end of all of this, the master politician Tokugawa Ieyasu finally managed to unify Japan under his shogunate and ushered in an era of peace, which lasted 250 or so years. But it's a time period that is rarely depicted in the West because it was a period when large armies and vast quantities of ordinary soldiers drilled to expertise made all the difference in combat. And there were individual generals and heroes and villains who made a lot of difference, but the feeling of the conflict was really, really different than the samurai media we tend to see in the West, which are focused on the Edo period, which was a time of peace during which young men with not enough to do would travel the country engaging in sword duels with each other for basically no reason, mm-hmm. which makes for a great story. It follows a similar format to the Western and ended up becoming the antecedent of a lot of well-known Western stories. But it was an era during which it was coming off of an era which defined the warrior ideal of the samurai as ruthless and practical. And then during peacetime, what it meant to be a warrior became something that was a lot more narratively useful. Mm-hmm. So Thousand Arrows is about the Warring States period, about the kind of samurai drama that you see in Kurosawa films such as Kagemusha or Ran, which are set against the backdrop of the Warring States period and mass battle. Mm-hmm. So Dragon King's Gambit was a Christacon at, I think it was a Dreamation, actually, which is another convention in New Jersey in that same series as Metatopia. Dragon King's Gambit is set in 1592, and it's both a long con and a wide con, so there are three tables, three game masters, 15 players, and it goes for three sessions. And the background of Dragon King's Gambit is that it's set in the winter of 1592. Japan has unified under Toyotomi Hideyoshi, the imperial regent, and Hideyoshi, in an attempt to conquer the world, has decided to go through Korea first. So he unifies much of Japan under his command and then sends a massive invasion fleet to attack Korea. Korea right now is in the middle of the Joseon period. Korea is not at all a world power at this point, and Korea has basically set aside any ideas of martial excellence. The martial arts and military science in Korea declined during this period, and Korean elites focused on arts and learning and Confucian ideals, and they relied on China for protection, because Korea at this point was a vassal state of China.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. So, and this went on for a long time, and Korea was pretty cool with the situation because Korean elites were really into cool foreign things from Japan and China. So when Japan invaded in 1591, Korea expected first that Japan would not be able to get past Korea's navy, which was excellent. Korea had really, really high-tech war galleys and cannon and artillery, and it was expected that the Japanese fleet, which didn't even have cannon, would not be able to get past the vastly superior Korean ships. Unfortunately, the Korean fleet's commanders were mostly there through nepotism and favor trading, and their defense was widely mismanaged. So the Japanese fleet broke through and made landfall, and some of the soldiers who were coming off of a 140-year tradition of nonstop violence and mass battle rushed into a state which had neither a half-decent, half-drilled standing army nor competent commanders. But that was okay, because they were just going to ask China for help. But, oh, China has been, oh, we've had a couple of civil wars, and we just have to put down this one rebellion over here and this one rebellion over there. We'll be right there, guys. We'll be right there. By the end of the year, Japan rolls all the way up to Pyongyang, and it looks like they're just going to keep going all the way into Korea. Or all the way into China, rather. So in Dragon King's Gambit, a Korean shaman, or Mudang, decides that the only way to avert certain destruction is to summon the Dragon King of the Eastern Sea to attack Korea and unify the Japanese, Chinese, and Koreans to fight back against this tide of sea monsters.
Of course.
Yeah. That's what I do, right? I mean... So the characters are, there are five Japanese characters, five Korean characters, and five Chinese characters. And at the start of the game, they're each at three different tables, which are split apart by nationality. Mm-hmm. And then the sea monsters attack, and all three armies have to come together and figure out what to do about a threat that they have to face together. And so they start to mingle amongst themselves, and they split off into different missions, each of which has to have Japanese, Chinese, and Korean agents there to make sure that no one is backstabbing anybody else. But of course, they're backstabbing each other.
Yeah.
Almost all 15 characters are real historical or mythological figures from East Asian history, with a couple of characters who I made up to fill roles which were real and which influenced this war and which influenced Korean society and Chinese society and Japanese society, but which we don't have really good records of. Because while certain Koreans and all Japanese kept really good records in this war, a lot of information about the common people especially was lost. It was estimated that up to maybe a third of Korea's population at this point were slaves or serfs. And while the form of servitude there was not as oppressive as, for example, chattel slavery in the Americas, it was not nearly as forgiving as many of the situations to which we have applied the word slavery throughout history. And Korea was racked by constant peasant and slave revolts, many of which actually ended up forming some of the resistance to the Japanese forces during the invasion, because Korea's standing armies kind of weren't.
Huh. And so you devised this scenario that is set in this combination of like mythical things and extremely compelling international military intrigue.
Yes.
And then you decided, you know, we should make a whole system to go around this.
More or less, yeah. This was in the early days of Thousand Arrows, just when we had started working on the system, but a lot of the forms and rules that we're working with today didn't yet appear in this system. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to run it again soon with the more modern, more current rules and structures that we have now. And there was a lot wrong with it, and there were a lot of problems, some of which I feel like we could have averted, others of which may be endemic just to what we were doing and the scope of what we were doing. Because in many ways it's a lot more like certain ambitious LARP events than it is like a lot of tabletop.
Yeah.
But it was one of the most satisfying game experiences that I've had, and seeing everybody walk into this room and get into this really widely cast net of historical and mythological characters was really, really gratifying.
Oh man, that's wonderful. So like, what was really exciting about it for you?
So there were a lot of really exciting things about it. It had some of my favorite characters in all of history and mythology. The leader on the Korean side, or one of the leaders on the Korean side, was Admiral Yi Sun Shin, who was a a random nobleman in Korea who was not very popular at court because he was kind of an ass. Yeah, he was kind of a smart aleck. And he ended up in command of part of Korea's navy, in spite of the fact that he had no naval training. But it ended up being fine because it turned out that he was the greatest admiral who would ever have lived or will live. Yes, including Nelson. Fight me IRL about this. Admiral Yi had almost no formal military training, but ended up being the most talented admiral ever, and was completely undefeated in sortie after sortie against the Japanese. There was a battle that he won when he was outnumbered something like 10-1, mm-hmm. Some ridiculous number like that. But I think he had like something like 13 ships against a number in the mid hundreds, and ended up beating the Japanese anyway. But in spite of his overwhelming talent and successes, the Korean government kept firing him and shuffling him into terrible positions and giving other awful commanders his job, until finally they had to call on him to save them in the end. Mm-hmm. So, and then in real history, he died tragically at the end of the war. It's really fun to see such a legend in play.
You find that people rise to a character like that.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah.
So having characters like him, historical characters alongside mythological characters. So for example, there's a semi-mythical Chinese figure called the White Eyebrow, he started out at the Shaolin Temple, and he was a Shaolin monk, but he got involved in Taoist black magic, whatever that is, and was implicated in one of the many hundreds of destructions of the Shaolin Temple. The Shaolin Temple is the most destroyed location in all of martial history. So, one of the more high-profile times the Shaolin Temple was destroyed, probably, he was involved. He set it on fire, or he betrayed it to the government, or he punched everyone inside to death. Reports differ. And the White Eyebrow keeps showing up in history over and over at times which are set apart from one another by hundreds of years.
Mm.
So, one of a few things is possible. The White Eyebrow could... So, perhaps people keep adopting the mantle of the White Eyebrow, even though they are not actually the White Eyebrow, but I think that's kind of the boring option compared to the White Eyebrow actually achieved Taoist immortality, or the White Eyebrow is constantly reincarnated.
Yeah. Time travel? Have we considered this option?
It's definitely an option.
Yeah.
I usually go with evil Taoist immortality.
Yeah.
But... In 1592, that was well within the window of his original life.
first crack, yes, at the bat.
Yes, his first crack. So he worms his way into the Chinese marshal's bodyguard, and in this particular run of Dragon King's Gambit, the White Eyebrow ended up basically becoming the final boss. Mm-hmm. The player stole all kinds of power for himself, died, became a zombie vampire, Jiangshi, came back, switched sides to hell. I don't really remember how hell got involved, but they were there by the end of the game.
It can happen.
Yes. And then one of the other characters, I think it was a Korean Vox spirit who ended up taking him out. So seeing this like juxtaposition of historical and mythical figures played to the hilt by people who may not have had any idea who these people were before the game was really, really special.
Yeah, I'm curious about that, because this is like a very complex and nuanced, mostly historical situation that involves cultures that a lot of North American gamers are not super familiar with. So how do you introduce people to that in a way that they feel competent and confident with it?
So this is really important, and it's one of the purposes of Thousand Arrows.
Mm-hmm.
The Thousand Arrows is designed not just to teach players to engage with the Japanese Warring States period in a respectful and exciting way, but to teach players to engage with history and mythology and unfamiliar cultures across their gaming lives and across their creative lives. And there are a number of best practices that we have developed which are built into the game. But one of the things that I like to emphasize is whenever you're teaching someone about an unfamiliar culture, one of the easiest and safest and most productive things to do is to emphasize the commonalities between their real life and this unfamiliar culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, Thousand Arrows, it has the Japanese terms for a lot of things in there, but every single word that can possibly be translated into English is translated into English in the text. And it'll tell you what the original Japanese is, and it'll even give you the Chinese characters for the Japanese words, but when there's a samurai, we call them a knight.
Interesting.
When there's a sohei, we call them a warrior monk.
Mm.
And I think it's really important, given that when we're talking about a French knight, we don't call them a chevalier, usually.
Huh.
You know, and mm-hmm. When we talk about a German, I don't know, knecht, is that what... I don't know the German for knight. But when we talk about a European knight, we use the English terms for them. When we talk about a Chinese or African or Japanese knight or an Indian knight, we use the in-language terms for them.
Mm.
But I think that it's just as appropriate to translate Kshatriya, for example, as knight. And there are a lot of differences between Indian Kshatriya and European warrior nobility, but the fundamental concept of warrior nobility is shared between those two regions. So it's important to emphasize that point of commonality to start with. And then once that commonality is understood, then you can go into some of the differences and where the Indian Kshatriya fit into the system of Varna or Jati compared to how the knights fit into the first, second, and third estates, for example, in Europe, and then to start looking at those differences. But starting with the commonalities gives people a place to start.
Hmm.
So Thousand Arrows does that through emphasizing those similarities in the text and emphasizing those similarities in the moves and the way that characters actually act, and it also represents them in the language used in the game. So when we talked about the white eyebrow, for example, there's an archetype that we've seen in fiction of a nefarious cackling, manipulating, evil sorcerer, and we've seen that in a lot of different places, and we have to be careful because it also rubs up against a lot of negative Asian stereotypes. For example, the Yellow Peril.
Yeah.
And we see more pernicious versions of a similar character to the white eyebrow, as, for example, Fu Manchu in Sax Rohmer's work.
Mm.
So those are things that we have to be really careful of. But one of the best bulwarks against characters, one of the best bulwarks against stereotype is diversifying your representation. For example, one of my favorite examples of this is Rogue One. So Donnie Yen plays this this ancient mystical staff fighting martial arts master who's constantly spouting aphorisms, and his head is always in the clouds, and he's talking about these lofty ideas that are hard to understand. And yes, this is absolutely a stereotype of the mystical Chinese martial arts master. But standing right next to him is Jiang Wen,
right,
who is acting in a completely, completely different way and has a different way of approaching the world, which contrasts with Donnie Yen's approach. And Jiang Wen's character doesn't really fit a very common Chinese archetype that we see a lot in Western fiction. So, yeah, I mean, the Donnie Yen character is kind of problematic in that sense, but the fact that there are multiple Chinese people in the work is... the importance of that cannot be overstated.
Right. So if you have these five central Chinese characters,
yes,
one of them can be the villain without it being like, very obvious and painful that, you know, your one Chinese character is this.
Definitely. And we still have to be aware of those stereotypes, and we still have to push against the stereotypes with that character whenever we have the option.
Mm-hmm.
But diversifying the representation and showing that not all Chinese people, hashtag not all Chinese people, are this way, for example, see the other four Chinese people standing right next to him, really helps.
Right. Right, and so people can engage with that, and recognize the fullness of those characters.
Exactly. So whenever they're choosing their character, it's not, okay, do I want to be the Chinese guy? It's which of these five Chinese people do I want to be? Which of these five archetypes do I want to get into and feels most comfortable for me?
Mm-hmm. Because I think there are lots of people who are engaging with, you know, material that is based on cultures totally unfamiliar to their own, totally thoughtlessly. And we have all done this, right? Totally thoughtlessly and being like, okay. But then there's also folks who start to realize that that the way that they've gamed with other cultures, so to speak, is not ideal and has not been very sensitive. And then they start to form this reaction like, well, I shouldn't play a character who isn't my own culture, or I shouldn't play in settings that aren't my own culture. But then everything is just super, super white.
Right.
So that's not a good option either.
Right. And so there's this spectrum, on one end you have representation with the risk of appropriation, and then on the other side you have erasure. Just with the risk of erasure. It's just erasure. There's just no one.
Yeah.
No one's going to tell you that your portrayal of Chinese people was racist, but you don't have any Chinese people. So shrug emoji.
Yeah.
And personally, I always want to see people attempt representation and fail. I would much rather see you try to do representation and then say, okay, cool, glad you tried, you made a bunch of mistakes, here's how you can improve, and then the next step after that is for you actually to listen and improve. But I will always be happier that people tried and failed than that they didn't show the courage to try at all.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's do that. Recently, I GM'd a game of Kagematsu for some of my friends on the One Shot Network. And I kind of said, like, I will run this game for you. I don't know if we're going to release it or not. I ran it. We had a lot of fun. And we were like, yeah, we really want to release this. It would be really fun. I think people would enjoy it. But at that point, you know, we decided, you know, we're a table of white people playing an all Japanese cast, and I bet we did a lot of stuff wrong. We should have someone look at this, listen to it, and give us some feedback, and then decide, A, should we release this, and B, you know, what happened here? what's going on? So I know you've just listened to it really recently.
Yes.
I'm wondering what your initial impressions are.
Sure. So do you want to give a quick gloss of what Kagematsu is?
Oh, sure. Thank you. So Kagematsu is a game for 3 to 5 players about the Warring States era in Japan, which we were just talking about. So it's in a situation where there's a village of people who, the village itself has been kind of emptied of able-bodied men just because of everyone being drafted into these wars. And there's some kind of external threat to the village. There's something happening, and there's no one around who can really defend against this threat. And then enter Kagematsu, this wandering ronin who would be able to maybe have a chance to defend the village. And so the GM, who must be a woman, plays the wandering ronin, and the players, who can be of any gender, play the women of the town who try to sway him from his meandering course and convince him to stick around and defend them. And it's a game I really love, and I've had really wonderful experiences, even though I know that it is, you know, written and designed and developed by white women, and definitely it shows, and there's things about it that are not perfect, and yeah, but playing a game at a table is different than playing a game for an audience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quickly, Alex, what's a Ronin?
Fuck! A knight? Wait, is he a knight? Because he doesn't have a master.
Right. So a Ronin, it literally means wave man, and it's because you're tossed and adrift on the waves. And it's a recent college graduate who hasn't gotten a job yet.
Oh my god.
Well, that's what it is now. In the Dwarring States period, it was a knight-errant, a masterless samurai. So samurai were all about fealty to their liege, and the Japanese believed that you couldn't really be a real knight unless you were answering to a lord, or you were the big lord yourself. But generally speaking, service to your superior was the measure of how good a knight you were. So if your lord died, then you yourself would be masterless, and that came with a corresponding drop in status, because there was this implication that you had failed your lord and gotten them killed, or that your lord had killed themselves for complicated reasons and you had decided not to follow them into death, or some similar situation which somehow was your fault. Mm-hmm. So given that people died constantly and frequently in Warring States era Japan, and life expectancy was something like 50, mm-hmm. Japan was full of these masterless samurai who would wander around Japan taking jobs for whoever they could run into, or becoming criminals, or drifting into other professions. There wasn't great documentation of what happened to many of these guys. But Kagematsu is one of these knights errant who is probably quite low in status, because even a knight errant was still a knight, but even a peasant isn't hated the way that a lot of knights hated knights errant. So I listened to Kagematsu recently, and I think that for the most part, your table didn't do a lot of things that were really offensive. But the way that you played the game still fell in line with a lot of really common stereotypes and assumptions that we tend to make about Japanese characters, and especially about the intersection of Japanese identity and gender identity. Mm-hmm. So this is a complicated subject. And partly this is a problem that's built into the text of Kagematsu, which was written quite a bit ago, and which is a really great attempt at this topic, but which still falls along the lines of certain stereotypes about what Japanese people in the Warring States period were like. And I'm not sure, like, I'm not ready to say that those were bad decisions. Like, some of those decisions were offensive or lined up with stereotypes or tropes, but they also do things in the game that are really valuable. So it's a really complicated situation, just as you would expect of intersectionality. But I think that a lot of the narrative decisions and character decisions made in your Kagematsu games, lined up with the most common images and the most common associations that we make with Japanese or East Asian manhood and East Asian womanhood. Mm-hmm. And in some places they diverged from some of the realities of the Warring States period, but I'm less concerned with historical accuracy and whether we got that stuff right than I am with how these kinds of things tend to affect how people view Asians in the real world.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Traditional Japanese narratives dating back to the Pillow Book and the Tale of Genji from the Heian period, which was 600 or so years before the Sengoku period, constructed a very, very different kind of masculinity and femininity than we might associate with modern Japan, realistically or unrealistically, or fairly or unfairly, perhaps. Or that we might associate with manhood or womanhood according to the Western conception of the patriarchy. So one major difference that you see both in The Tale of Genji, which was the first novel ever written by a woman at the Heian court, and also in traditional war narratives like The Tale of the Heike, which describes the Genpei Wars, is that men are extremely emotionally expressive, and men are liable to overwhelming emotional outbursts. So at the beginning of any battle in The Tale of the Heike, what was likely to happen was a man would ride forward from one side and announce himself as the Flower of Knighthood and say something really depressing and really deep and very sad, and the whole other army would burst into tears, and then one of the crying knights from that side would ride forward and he would say something deep, and then the whole first army would burst into tears, and it's unclear how anyone would hit anybody else with an arrow because everyone was crying all over themselves all the time. And in peacetime in the Heian court, there's a scene in The Tale of Genji which always sticks with me, where a woman catches a man having put water on his face before a date so it looks like he was crying about her.
Right.
So, and then there's this idea of, at least in social circumstances, of women being a little bit more calculating and strategizing. So the Pillow Book, which was sort of a... ostensibly the diary of another noblewoman who was a contemporary of the author of The Tale of Genji at the Heian court, but was probably actually some combination of like linguistic theory treatise and an explanation of how this woman very quietly dunked on everyone at the court. also has this idea of the author as very calculating and measured and precise with her use of her social skills and social engineering to get ahead and cement her position at court, while at the same time being expressive and delicate and vulnerable at times. So both of those ways that manhood and womanhood are expressed in these contexts can also be negative and pernicious, and they can be taken to extremes that might look familiar from the standpoint of Western patriarchy, like, you know, the outburst of emotion can become an outburst of anger or something like that, and this calculating idea can play into stereotypes of women as conniving, and so those can be bad. Especially in this modern context, but Japanese people did have somewhat different associations with some of the signifiers that we're used to playing with in a modern context. But those associations between men and emotional outburst and women and strategy don't necessarily make it into Western conceptions of what Japanese and East Asian people are like, whether either in the modern day or in the Warring States period. So, in the modern day, I'm not really sure why this particular stereotype ended up getting applied to Asians, but I think that it dates back to as far back as the Mongol Terror, which was, I think, the origin of a lot of our Yellow Peril stereotypes. There was this idea that the Mongols were going to conquer the world, and that even long after the Mongols would be exterminated, they had left this indelible, horrific stain on the world, which was expressed as entirely in terms of Mongol miscegenation on the women of all of the people who they conquered. Mm-hmm. And there's this I don't know, I view it as a canard. It might be true, it might not. I'm not a geneticist, but there's this common idea that some unreasonably high percentage of people in the world carry the genes of Genghis Khan because of his
I've heard this.
Yeah, vast quantities of wives and so on and so forth. And I guess it might be true, but this characterization of these oppressors as cupidous monsters.
And it's also very much around, like, we're going to excuse our racialized violence in defense of white women.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Which is the most common tactic ever.
Right.
Yeah.
And certainly rape culture was a thing that existed in the ancient Asian world. And in fact, I view The Tale of Genji, which is the first novel ever written, as a condemnation, a detailed condemnation of rape culture. And that is still deeply relevant, I think, to its modern expression. It's given how close this genetic idea is to the kinds of slurs that tend to be applied to conquerors, and it is difficult for me to take it entirely seriously as a way to characterize Mongols as different from other exponents of rape culture in the ancient world.
Well, and also as other, how am I going to say this? Like, rape is always a tool of war.
Yes.
Like, regardless of who is doing the warring.
Mm-hmm. And in, generally speaking, it's also easy to find records that certain armies didn't use rape as when those armies are ever held up as examples of honor or martial prowess that we should look up to. And the Red Flag Fleet, the Chinese pirate fleet, was extolled as having rules against sexual assault, which it's difficult to get any kind of real data on. And then other descriptions of the Mongol hordes say that they didn't engage in sexual assault, or they engaged in it far less than other armies when they're trying to hold them up as these paragons of martial honor. So there are so many layers of agenda and prejudice over the years that it's difficult to take this honestly kind of genetically essentialist idea really seriously. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not a geneticist, so it's difficult for me to speak authoritatively on this subject, but I do know what the effects of this characterization are on modern misconceptions or negative stereotypes about Asians. So characterizations of East Asians very often feminize everybody. So women's submissive and pliant and weak qualities are overemphasized, their delicacy, their elegance, and the way in which the men of their society control them become writ really, really large. And we hear all about things like foot binding or of emperors having loads and loads of female concubines, and they also had loads of male concubines, but we don't really often hear about those in translation. Correspondingly, men are characterized as both more feminine in their physical attributes or in their behaviors, and desperate, especially desperate to intermingle with the women of other ethnicities. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in the 1930s, there were miscegenation laws introduced into, I think it was the Washington State Legislature, and hopefully the notes can correct me if I'm misremembering this, but in the Pacific Northwest, there was an influx of male Filipino immigrants because the United States conquered the Philippines in around 1900, and there were a lot of Filipino men coming to work in the United States, and of course, relatively few Filipino women. So Filipino men commonly married Native American or white American women. And Filipino men as a miscegenation threat led to the introduction of two bills into the I think Washington State Legislature outlawing miscegenation for everyone, but particularly targeted towards this this fate of Filipino men intermingling. Mm-hmm. And Filipino activists successfully campaigned against both of these laws, and they did not actually end up getting passed. Mm-hmm. But I think this is an example of how the threat of Asian manhood and the threat of Asian culture infiltrating Western culture and taking it over through sexual means is a really, really common meme that has survived since the Mongol Terror until today. And it underlies a lot of yellow peril stereotypes, which also date back to this this overwhelming, somewhat reasonable and somewhat unreasonable fear of what the Mongols were doing. So what this means for the characterization of Asian characters is that there's a pretty narrow range of characterizations of Asians and characterizations of Asian manhood and womanhood that are considered safe and acceptable, and that we're likely to see in Western media. Mm-hmm. And they're stereotypes, but they're not really negative stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes. And they aren't even really exotification or orientalism necessarily, or at least they don't seem that way at first, because they fall within the range of acceptable, reasonable characterizations of manhood and womanhood. They're safe. Huh. And they're safe from a lot of different cultural and political perspectives.
Hmm.
So in terms of Asian manhood, it means that an Asian man who wants to represent his manhood but still be acceptable to different echelons of society and to different cultures' views of manhood has to kind of lock down his signifiers. He has to kind of lock down his expressions. So the strong silent type is the safest thing for an Asian man to be. So a lot of the heroes of the Tale of the Heike and of the Sengoku era in history and of the Heian era weren't strong silent types. The greatest warlord of, or the most famous warlord of the Warring States era was Oda Nobunaga, who was pretty clearly, pretty severely mentally ill. And I have bipolar disorder, so I like to say Oda Nobunaga has bipolar disorder, but that's not actually a scientific opinion. he was extremely emotionally volatile, and he was a really, really talented logistician and a really, really talented strategist, but he was known for his erratic behavior, his flouting of ritual and etiquette and ceremony, and just being completely unpredictable at any kind of in any kind of polite or martial situation. So he was not at all the strong silent type. He was the exact opposite. But and he managed to be, and in Japanese narratives, or not in narratives, in Japanese conceptions, he's often viewed as the paragon of what the Warring States period was all about. The same way that in a Heian context, the greatest exponents of... So two of the most popular and best-loved male heroes in the Tale of the Heike were Minamoto no Yoshitsune and his bodyguard Saito Musashi Bobenkei, the warrior monk, neither of whom also really counted as the strong silent type. Yoshitsune was elegant and graceful and delicate compared to a lot of the other warlords and knights of the Tale of the Heike. And when he met Benkei, who was this giant, tough warrior monk who was a pretty emotionally volatile guy, which was how he ended up not at the monastery where he trained, mm-hmm. Yoshitsune defeated him using elegance and grace and delicacy and humor. And then they became best friends. So the strong silent type doesn't really become writ large in a lot of Japanese fiction until we see more modern day portrayals. So the one that you drew on when you were coming up with your version of Kagematsu was Mifune Toshiro's performance in Yojimbo, which is an awesome movie. Mm-hmm. And he's an awesome actor and he's an awesome character, but Yojimbo is also very different from a lot of other Kurosawa films starring Mifune, because So Mifune was Kurosawa said that Mifune could express emotion in a much shorter distance or much less film or something like that. I forget what the precise number and the precise metaphor was, but he said that basically that Mifune could convey with a glance that another actor needed to convey with an entire scene.
Mm-hmm.
So he's talking there about Mifune's emotional content in his in his portrayals, and in Yojimbo and Sanjuro, where Mifune is playing this wandering badass, he doesn't use a lot of his emotional expressive range. And he's portraying a hero which is influenced a lot by Westerns, for example. The same way that Yojimbo and Sanjuro ended up influencing later Westerns, there was also a good deal of Western influence on Yojimbo and Sanjuro themselves. So,
right. So this is reminding me of like how different that Toshirô Mifune character is from, like, for example, what he plays in Throne of Blood.
Exactly.
Right? Where it's just like he is just totally over the top, flipping out, like yelling, exactly, screaming, like from scene one to the final curtain.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Which is what I really love about it, because I loved Macbeth, but I always find that it's difficult for me to humanize the characters of Lord and Lady Macbeth. And mm-hmm. then in Throne of Blood, the Kurosawa adaptation, Mifune's portrayal of Macbeth gives him so much humanity and so much emotional, emotional impression, expression rather, that he fills in the holes in Shakespeare's Macbeth for me.
Hmm.
And conversely, Lady Macbeth, I forget the name of the actor playing Lady Macbeth, but she is extremely reserved and calculating and strategic. So we're seeing in Throne of Blood how those characters carry forward the ideas of manhood, Japanese manhood and Japanese womanhood, that we've seen as far back as the Heian era.
Right.
And that's in a Shakespeare adaptation.
Uh-huh.
So, nonetheless, expressing those kinds of expressions of emotion and those kinds of and that kind of strategic thinking aren't really acceptable in a lot of Western society and in Western binary conceptions of that are handed down by the patriarchy. So it's not really safe for Mifune Toshirô to be Captain Washizu from Throne of Blood. It's a lot safer for him or for any other Asian man acting out his manhood to be Sanjuro from Yojimbo and Sanjuro. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to be the strong silent type, and it's okay for an Asian man to be the strong silent type, but
right.
It's a narrow road to walk. And
I can tell you that I have generally stayed, I'm realizing now, pretty close to that archetype. I have played Kagematsu many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And Kagematsu, the text itself kind of doesn't do you any favors there. I don't mean to sound quite so negative. I think Kagematsu is a really cool book, and I think that some of these effects are really cool. But Kagematsu, the text, does sort of put a premium on Kagematsu's own emotional expression and Kagematsu's own vulnerability.
Yeah, you're sort of kind of mechanically incentivized to mm-hmm. be very emotionally withholding.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about how that works?
Oh, yeah. So basically, the townswomen are trying to earn your love, but they could also, by the same actions, mechanically, be earning your pity. And so in order to kind of, as the GM, keep them guessing and keep this sort of like, keep this tension into the story, you want them to be kind of continually looking for that love rather than just kind of getting down to the math of it and saying, okay, we have enough love, let's go on and do that, because that wouldn't be as fun. So you're really incentivized to both have them want to earn your love, which unfortunately being really withholding is like a way to get people to do that. Mm-hmm. And also to make them wonder whether or not they have it or how much of it they have. And so there really is like a really good reason to kind of like reinforce that to a certain degree.
Yeah. So that's a really cool effect, and it has really interesting effects on gender portrayal in Kagematsu. But the types of gender portrayals that it does evoke tend to be in line with this safe road to walk. Mm. And then on the flip side, the characterization of women in Kagematsu, there's this... So the women are taking these actions that will encourage Kagematsu to show them love or pity. And both love and pity are paths to getting Kagematsu to do what you want, right? Mm-hmm. And then the things that they tend to be going for, or rather, so the tools that they have to get Kagematsu to do what they want end up being, if you're going for both love and pity, then the safest path for you to walk is to be beautiful but delicate and fragile. Mm-hmm. So if you're beautiful and you're desirable, then Kagematsu will want to love you, and if you're fragile and vulnerable, then Kagematsu will be inclined to give you pity, or he'll also be inclined to protect you and come save the village. And so in Kagematsu, or in the Kagematsu game that I listened to, we had four female characters, and the female character who seemed to struggle the most in terms of her roleplay was, I forget the name of the character, but she was the bathhouse attendant. Mm-hmm. And so she took care of the bath, and she was really into weightlifting and bodybuilding, which was really cool. But in terms of her roleplay, she struggled a lot more to interact with Kagematsu, because Kagematsu was this strong silent type, and she was a little bit more boisterous and expressive, and showed a lot more personal vulnerability and personal weakness, and that was fine, and that was really cool, and it was really great to have different conceptions or different kinds of representations of Asian womanhood, the same way that it's good to have both Donnie Yen and Jiang Wen in Star Wars. So that was really, really cool to see. But the characters who were a little bit more mysterious and delicate and reserved, who were able to show more fragility, had a much easier time getting what they wanted out of Kagematsu.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. There is kind of a... Yeah, like a slight mechanical disincentive to not embodying that kind of stereotype.
Yes. Yeah. So Kagematsu and also Western society in general make it really difficult to follow those, just those two, and I just brought up two, those two more traditional Japanese expressions of manhood and womanhood, because a calculating woman ends up becoming a yellow peril stereotype because she becomes a dragon lady. Right. And she's manipulating Westerners as some kind of cackling, manipulating, sexy in an evil way overlord. Mm-hmm. And the emotionally expressive Japanese man ends up contributing to his own feminization, because tears aren't okay in the West, and they aren't viewed as a cool, badass, manly thing to do the way that they are in the Tale of the Heike. So the emotional outburst makes you look threatening, and then the tears make you look feminine. So you're both accentuating the threat that you pose, the yellow peril that you pose, and you're accentuating the ways in which Western society is right that you're much more feminine than European men, African men, etc., etc., etc. So being the strong silent type and deviating from that Japanese, from that traditional Japanese norm is a lot safer. And it's, again, it's fine to be the strong silent type. That's a real thing in the world, and a lot of people are strong and silent and really guarded and reserved about their emotional expression, and it's okay for Asian men to be that. Mm-hmm. But it also means that if you're an Asian man who deviates from that, you have a much harder time. The same way that an Asian woman who is who is loud and boisterous and not submissive and reserved and retiring, has a difficult time because she's bucking the norm that's pushed on her by Western society, because Western society traditionally commodifies Asian women as labor or as partners or as anything in between.
So then to portray characters like that is reinforcing that that is what Asian men and women should be or are naturally.
It kind of is.
Yeah.
So specifically, I would say portraying Asian men and Asian women only as those things is reinforcing those stereotypes. Again, if we want to have a complete picture of Asian masculinity and Asian femininity, we need variation, both in terms of adherence to Western and Japanese norms and breaking those. The bathhouse attendant wasn't really in line with either Western or Japanese traditional conceptions of womanhood, but she was still really cool, and she was still a character who really reminded me of a lot of women I know, both Asian and non-Asian.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to be in there too, because there are real people like her. And this is without even getting into conceptions of non-binary Japanese people,
mm-hmm.
Which, so in a traditional Japanese context, there were lots of non-binary expressions, but they were often described or characterized in terms of like the black and white binary. There wasn't a lot of description of the gray area in between, which would kind of make them seem like rounded characters to a modern eye. And I think that another reason that it's difficult when you're working with Kagematsu is that so in the Warring States era context, romance was or the kind of high romance that Kagematsu leans towards, not so much the like, oh, we're gonna try and seduce this guy so he'll fight a lava monster for us, but
mm-hmm.
the idea of like that actually you're going to find true love out there, and there's actually going to be this real connection between this innocent village girl and this badass tough ronin. That isn't really the common Warring States era ideal of high romance. When you talk about those kinds of romance and like the love that you choose and the love that you decide that you're going to commit yourself to, in the Warring States period, among knights, that was mostly something that you'd expect to find with another knight.
Right, that's right, because they have like there's a Greek word for it too, right?
Yeah, in Japanese, we tend to refer to this as wakashudo.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a similar thing going on with both Japanese and Greek versions of this, where it's highly ritualized. You have to essentially be trained in it. And there are very specific roles for the older male partner and then the younger male partner, who is, unfortunately, from a modern conception, super underage. But
yeah.
But you became, you were considered to be a consenting adult way earlier in, Japanese and Greek society. But at any rate, so marriages with women and, liaisons with concubines were considered to be, either frivolous or, for the purpose of cementing a marriage or for the purpose of generating heirs. But if you were a man who engaged in wakashudo with another man, often it was a knight and another knight, or perhaps sometimes it was a Buddhist monk and another Buddhist monk. There would be the older partner who was the one who penetrated the younger partner, never the other way around. Not that anyone would have been able to police that.
but we're talking about the ideals of the society ideal, here.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. But mm-hmm. so certainly, of course, everybody always in the privacy of their command tent always adhered to this ideal. So only one partner got to do any penetrating, and that was the older partner. And then the older partner was also supposed to instruct the younger partner in the precepts of knighthood and the practice of martial arts and the science of strategy and logistics and all of these things, until such time as the younger partner was ready to become older partner to someone somebody else. So there was this both master-student relationship and this romantic relationship, which was often cemented with contracts and declarations of true love and declarations of monogamy, which was a pretty rare and special thing because you could have as many wives and concubines as society would allow you to. There wasn't really a limit on those, but it wasn't really cool to be dating a lot of men. You had your one man and you had a serious relationship with him. So that's the... That's one of the most common Heian era and previous ideals of romantic love, and I know there are lots of like kagematsu games.
Yes,
that's also a common thing, but drawing on Warring States era sources. A lot of the really famous romances are like between Takeda Shingen and. I can never remember the name of his great general. But Takeda Shingen was this noted libertine who was, who would go to bed with anything that moved. But when he got together with this one general who wasn't that much younger than him, like they were relatively closer in age, he signed a contract of monogamy with this general.
Gasp.
Which was totally out of character for this guy, and who knows if he adhered to it, but...
Yeah, but that's the things people do for love.
Exactly, but that's the story. So I think that, you know, when you originally asked me, do I think that your kagematsu game was offensive or racist, we can go number by number, and I can pick out a few moments when I kind of narrowed my eyes or cringed a little bit, but there aren't that many. And the major choices that you made in terms of the characterization of all the characters, that's the thing. Like, they aren't offensive. They're okay. They're acceptable. And they're within the range of normal portrayals of Japanese manhood or manhood in general and femininity in general and Asian femininity in particular. They're fine. But they're also in line with what we usually get. And
right.
There's not a lot out there that bucks those trends either in the direction of traditional Japanese conceptions or in the direction of real people who have all kinds of weird things going along with them.
Yeah.
So I think that people should definitely like listen to that kagematsu game, and there's a lot of good stuff to get out of it. But they should probably also remember that when they themselves are making characters or writing fiction or describing people in their lives, that they need to understand that there are some things out there that are safer than others for how Asians are allowed to act, and that they in their own portrayals of Asians and in their own portrayals of Asian characters have the power to buck those trends as well. And any realistic character who has any relationship to a stereotype is going to contain both elements that do fall in line with the stereotype and elements that don't. And this is true of every rounded character. Mm-hmm. And it's important to recognize the stereotypes, both positive and negative, that come up over and over again in media. So even if you were in line with common stereotypes in kagematsu, I think that we can still learn from those, and we can still take something away from those that will then strengthen our own portrayals of Asian characters and characters in general.
Well, good. I'm really glad that that since we decided to share it, that it can be a learning tool.
Definitely.
You know, it's certainly been a learning opportunity for me just talking about it. And I really appreciate you taking the time to do that.
Thank you. And I really appreciate you sharing it with me. And I really appreciate that you and your players were able to be vulnerable and open yourselves up to critique and consider how you might improve. Because I was talking earlier about the difference between erasure on one end of the spectrum and the risk of portrayal and appropriation and mischaracterization on the other. So this was this kagematsu game had a lot of things that were far from perfect, but what we're listening to right now is the beginning of the process of improvement.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That makes me happy. Well, yeah. Thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. This is totally rad.
Thank you.
You do a lot of really fun and cool and interesting writing on lots of different projects. So if my listeners are interested in hearing about that, where should they go?
Finding me on Twitter is great. I'm at Lula Vampiro, and we can provide a link to my website where I do lots of other writing and have links to all kinds of my work in the description. And if anybody else wants me to sensitivity read their stuff, I want to do for everyone what I was able to do for this Kagematsu game. Because whoever you are out there, no matter how much of a mess the things you send me are, I will always be happier that you showed those things to me than that you didn't try at all. And I'm thanking you right now. I'm pre-thanking you all for your vulnerability and grace and courage in showing me all of your various racist portrayals of things. I'm really excited to see them and to help you out.
Okay, one last question before we leave.
Yes.
Because I know how into so many various different kinds of martial arts you are.
Yes.
And because I have read Fist City, your Fiasco playset about warrior idiots.
Yes.
And their secret lives. I was recently having a conversation where we were discussing what kind of sword I should use if I was going to use a sword.
Oh.
I was wondering if you could offer an opinion about this.
Okay. So I have often been characterized as a sword guy, but this is a bit of a mischaracterization. I find swords really frustrating. I think they're really hard to use compared to other weapons, and I think spears and glaives and knives are way more efficient and also much easier for me to use because I don't have a lot of upper body strength, and I also don't have a lot of time to practice with just one weapon. And, you know, it takes years of practice and great strength and grace and agility to become really good at fighting with a sword, but, you know, you can just kind of pick up a spear and just kind of stand there and make a jacking off motion and kill someone with a sword really, really easily.
Are you saying I should take up the spear?
Yes, I think you should take up a very large, heavy weapon, because very large, heavy weapons are actually way better for generating power than things like swords. Like, I really love dual-wielding katana and wakizashi, but I shouldn't really do it because it requires lots of arm strength and wrist strength and so forth to make that happen. Whereas I can, you know, if I pick up a giant, heavy pole arm, then I can hold that in my arms, and then I can generate power by moving my legs and hips around. And I can also keep enemies who are much taller and have much better reach at a distance and make up for the lack of reach and strength that I have. So,
okay, so two things. One, all of my power is in my legs and hips. And two, my greatest frustration in life is that people are taller and have better reach than I do. So, yeah, pole?
Yep. Any kind of pole weapon, spears or glaives are now associated with they were traditionally associated with warrior monks in Japan, but in the modern day, most masters of the Naginata are female, for really complicated reasons. But yeah, spears and glaives are definitely, I'd say, like, heavy and two-handed weapons in general are much better choices for people who worry about strength and reach than dual-wielding and katana and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even play tennis without getting
wrist
troubles.
Right? Yeah, neither can I. So, yeah.
Well, thanks again to Mendez for joining us. And as always, thank you for listening. If you have thoughts on today's show, you can always email me, that's backstorypodcast@gmail.com, or you can find me on Twitter @backstorycast. Backstory is hosted by me, Alex Roberts, and is produced by the talented Alex Sisk. We're hosted on the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com to find more great RPG-related shows like Total Party Kill. Total Party Kill is a weekly live Twitch stream where John Patrick Cohen, Eddie Klinker, and James Dugan play through Cephalofair Games' Gloomhaven. join them in the stream to play along through the action and interact with a constantly changing cast of characters and special guests, or watch them after the fact on the OneShot YouTube channel. Total Party Kill airs Thursdays at 7 p.m. Central at twitch.tv/oneshotrpg. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can find UJICO on SoundCloud, Spotify, YouTube, and wherever else you get your chill beats. Talk to you later, friends.